If Athena Fan, YouTube content creator and fan of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, was asked what her favorite podcast was, I am sure she would say,
"Digital watches are a pretty neat idea."
And who could blame her? Hi there, this is Jeff. I'm with my friend Brian, and we'll be talking about The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy in all its forms. But before we do that, let's listen to a message from one of our proud sponsors.
This episode of Digital Watches Are a Pretty Neat Idea is brought to you by the Pangalactic Gargle Blaster, the best drink in existence. Invented by ex-president of the galaxy, Zaphod Beetlebrox, it's like having your brain smashed out by a slice of lemon wrapped around a large gold brick. Zaphod says never drink more than 2 Pangalactic Gargle Blasters unless you are a 30-ton mega elephant with bronchial pneumonia. After 2 of these babies, the dullest, most by-the-book Vogon will be up on the bar in stilettos yodeling Malkin shanties and swearing he's the king of the gray binding fiefdoms of Saxaquin. The Pangalactic Gargle Blaster, the best drink in existence. Order 2 today.
Hey Brian, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Jeff. How are you?
Well, I feel like a kid again.
You feel like a kid again?
Yeah, because I get to watch the show with the guy in his pajamas.
Yep, that's true.
We are going to be talking about the BBC TV Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy that came out in the mid-80s.
That's correct. I've got 1981 is the date that date that I came up with.
Early 80s. Wonderful.
Yeah, it actually was commissioned or requested in the final draft anyway, was requested in August of 79. And I looked it up because I was curious about the timing, and that's what I found out. I think it was actually released in 1981.
Very good.
Early 81.
It was earlier than I expected.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other reason I thought about that is, I guess we'll get into it a little bit later on.
All right. So we're going to talk less about the story and more about how effectively or ineffectively they adapted the radio script into the TV show.
Yes, because it's clearly obvious that this is an adaptation of the radio show when you watch these 6 episodes.
Yes. It matches up with the radio series perfectly.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. They've even kept the same cast, so you don't have to get used to any new voices or anything, and you get to see how everybody looked.
Yes, yes.
I loved Ford's outfit. It was clownish, I think, is the best way to to describe it. And it does imply that there is something a little bit off about him.
Yes, No, I didn't really think about that, but you're right. The big striped coat, it does seem a little bit off with the pattern-on-pattern approach that he's got going on there. I also thought it was interesting because, like you said, this is a lot of the cast from the radio show, and I did try to dig in a little bit to see where they went from here, and nobody really had an illustrious career, but they did have a bit of a career here and there.
What I liked was when you're watching this, there's always the portion of the guide. And when they are going to do an entry from the guide or the Encyclopedia Galactica, they do some sort of video animation. And it's not just some simple, easy to follow animation. There is way more information than you could ever process in a single viewing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Some of the most interesting comments I had about what we were watching today was as a result of what was up on the screen in that can only be viewed but not spoken about, you know?
Right. So I found that to be a very effective use of the TV medium for this. I mentioned it a little bit later, but I'm going to bring it up right at the beginning. The radio program is a radio program. It is audio only, and they did very little script changing from audio to this TV. So it's very, I don't know, I would say wordy. It's a lot of dialogue without a lot of stage action. So unfortunately, there are a lot of scenes that are very static and people are just standing there or or and talking.
Yes.
So they do not use action very well in many of these episodes.
Yes, I agree with that. That's true.
So we're going to start out with episode one. And even though I have listened to the radio show and the LP version of this material, and even though I have read the book, and even though I know he discovers the bulldozers upon waking up, and I know at the pub with Ford, he says lunchtime, it wasn't until the timestamp of the countdown to the destruction of Earth that I truly understood how long Arthur had been laying in the mud.
Yeah, I never thought about that. That is true
He
because they
was
do give
laying
you
in the mud for 5 hours.
Timescale.
You don't get that out of the book or the radio show.
No, you don't.
The information's there.
And what? Yeah, wonders why that's laid out like that. Is it? It's so that they can talk about going to the pub at lunchtime, I guess.
I guess so, because they didn't change any of the dialogue. It's he wakes up, he's there. Ford shows up. They don't ever let us know how long he's been laying there. He's has a couple of conversations, but it doesn't say he's been laying in the mud for 5 hours. It's just when they go to the pub, Ford says lunchtime.
Right.
Doubly so.
Right,
When he
exactly.
said 6 pints at lunchtime or 3 pints at lunchtime.
Right, and the only other thing you can think about is he does wake up with a hangover, so we can assume that he slept late,
That's
you know.
true. That
You
is true.
know, so that makes sense.
My first disappointment in this episode was about a wardrobe choice.
Okay.
L. Prosser was wearing a wool flat cap when he should have been wearing a little fur hat.
That, yep. I didn't really catch that, but I agree. We lost that reference. And
Yes.
they don't even do a little reference, do they, to his heritage?
Yes, they do. Hey, this is Jeff here, just cutting in to let you know they don't. Yes,
Okay.
yeah, they do, but it gets lost because he's not wearing the hat. And in the book,
Right.
he even expands on it and does the Three Stooges curly thing that you're not too fond of.
Yep. Yeah, somewhere in here where they talk about the ape descendants and when oh yeah, I know what it is. When Ford comes up to Arthur right before that, they mention that you know, due to the fact that they've had so many years of evolution that they no longer pick fleas off each other.
Right.
But then they have this kind of cutaway scene, which I thought was sort of funny. They show a family sitting down to dinner, and there's a monkey across the table from them, and
Correct.
there's a sign that flashes up saying, "This never happens. This never
Right.
happens."
Yes, again, I thought that was a very good use of a way to expand visually without having to expand vocally. They
Right,
didn't have to
right.
add any new dialogue, but in the background, you just have something to watch while they're reading this excerpt from the guide in the ancestry of ape-descended life forms.
And it's always the tiny little things that, since you and I've seen so much and read so much and heard so much, that I get a little kick out of. But they're just as Ford and Arthur are leaving Arthur's home, and Prosser is going down into the mud. I'm sorry, Arthur says to Ford, "I'm not dressed to go to the pub."
Oh, I didn't even catch that line. And I can't even tell you how many times I've watched it.
So it's the only reference to his attire that they make during the show. Did you happen to see Douglas Adams in the bar as a patron?
I did not. Was
Yes.
he in the
Yes.
bar in the back down there?
Yes,
Yeah.
he
I
was.
know he does make cameos in this, but I probably didn't catch all of them. In the radio series, they never name the pub. And in the book, it is the Horse and Groom.
Right.
But in this TV show, they showed that it was the Red Lion. Mm-hmm. And I was a little curious, and I wondered if there was a reason. And my suspicion was that it was because that was the name of the pub where they filmed the show. And so I did look it up, and I was right.
Oh, great. That's so awesome.
I like that. They just used the name of the pub where they did the filming.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
My next little disappointment came from being a little confused that it was said that there was a fleet of flying saucers when the Vogons mm-hmm. were going to destroy the Earth. But
right.
there only seemed to be one at the mm-hmm. end there when the Earth was blown up.
Right.
So where did
right.
all the other ones go?
I'm not really sure. But again, one of the parts of that's, well, prior to that, the Earth blowing up scene is they're talking about the Pangalactic Gargle Blaster.
Oh, yes.
And the places where you can go to get the best ones and the facilities that are there to help you recover from having drank a Pangalactic Gargle Blaster.
Correct. That is another one of the video animations that has way more information thrown at you.
Right, and I got a kick out of one of them mentions that if you happen to be a kidney donor, then you get a 25% discount. I just thought that was funny.
Yes.
For me, one of the little disappointments was the demolition of Earth, the way they went ahead and did that. I know you and I have had many conversations about how effective the line is in the book and yes. how effectively or how much we enjoy that particular approach that they use. But here the demolition is, you know, almost, it's you know, corny. It looks like a tennis ball blows up or something.
Right, right.
You know, and they didn't spend too much money on that particular effect.
No. One of the things that they should have done to better, well, I guess the line is from the book. It's not from the radio series.
Mm-hmm.
So they are just, but if they did want to incorporate something from the book into this a little bit, they needed to have a hush come over the Earth where all of the screaming, protesting people all of a sudden realized that this just got real and went silent.
Right.
You know, because there was terrible, ghastly silence,
mm-hmm.
then the terrible, ghastly noise, then the terrible, ghastly silence.
Correct.
But, they did as little as they could to show the destruction of the Earth. And then up on the Vogon ship, they did a little additional scene. So it's always nice to get some new material to watch. Ford was excited to find a dish that he likes prepared by the Dentrassi. And here's where they use the visuals to make the food really look alien.
Mm-hmm.
It was some sort of blue-colored bread, and then Ford put, like, guacamole on top of it and gave it to Arthur to try. And Arthur hated it and spit it out. And Ford couldn't believe that he didn't like it, and then took his own bite, and then he made a face and said, "They must really hate the Vogons."
Yep.
So something that has always bothered me in every version of the story, it's in the radio series, it's on the LP, it's in this TV show, it's in the book. They didn't put it in the movie, so they've left it out of the movie. And when Arthur is trying to find Earth in the guide, Ford says that it is under Eccentrica Galumbitz.
Right.
Not over it. So that adds to my theory that the book is backwards. Because mm-hmm. if you remembered in the illustrated book episode, I said yep. that the picture of the book looked like the Don't Panic was on what we would consider the back cover.
Right.
So if the book does run backwards, that would explain why, if, you know, bottom right to top left, then Eccentrica would be under or over, in this case, Earth.
Yeah, the one thing that I haven't heard you mention yet, and I know you're a fan of these inconsistencies, but how is it that the words "don't panic" are legible by every person who actually looks at the
Well, we've decided that that's because they have a babelfish.
But he doesn't have one when he first gets it. And when they first talk about it, they say that that's what's written on the front of cover of the book.
Oh, so when he gets the book for the first time, he doesn't have a babelfish in his ear.
No, he doesn't.
Does the guide, does he read anything in the guide, or does the guide speak to him?
I don't recall exactly, and I probably should have done a little more research on that. No, it's just that when they describe the book and they describe it with the "don't panic" on the cover, I've always wondered about that because a person who didn't speak whatever language "don't panic" was written in wouldn't know what it says
Right.
on
Right.
the cover. You know, because they didn't establish that there was any kind of universal language. And we know it's the
Exactly.
babelfish that allows him to read and understand what he's looking at. So, so I do like when they first get to the Vogon ship that this is where they've actually gotten that whole sequence of statements correct, where Arthur is talking about what happened to him, and they get the "is green, yes" correct.
Yes, they got it correct in this. Yes.
As I know, we've debated that also. But I do like the little comment also when they're flying through hyperspace and Ford says, tells Arthur to put the towel down between his feet and sit there like this, etc. And they lie down on the floor. That's when Ford makes the joke about it's uncomfortably like being drunk. And
Right.
then Arthur says, well, what's uncomfortable about being drunk? And Ford says, well, ask a glass of water.
Yes.
And after they wake up from the transition in hyperspace, the towel has moved from their feet to their head.
Right.
And Ford sort of makes an inference there that he understands how far they went by how far the towel moved.
Correct. Doesn't really make sense, but okay.
Which is kind of an interesting thing. But I also think I love the line where, as Arthur wakes up, he says, I'll never be cruel to a gin and tonic again.
Right. Right. So that brings us to episode two. And the best part of this episode, or probably the whole series, is of course that it pretty much starts out with a cameo by Douglas Adam.
Yes.
Douglas Adams, who portrays one of the people unhappy most of the time.
Right.
And he's one that decided that the trees were a mistake and nobody should have come out of the ocean, and basically strips down and walks butt naked into the ocean.
I love that scene. He throws the money in the air and just struts on into the ocean. Nothing to care about.
We get a little shot of the cafe in Rickmansworth, which is called the Silver Slipper.
Okay.
I'm guessing that is just the cafe that they shot at.
I do like, and we've talked about it a couple different times here, where there's something on the screen that's not being read or spoken about by the guide, but it's informational.
Yes.
And they're talking about the different poems and poets. They talk about the Vogons, they talk about the, what the heck's the name of those guys? The traveling poets of, oh, Grentzhof the Flatulent.
Yes.
What's his name? Renthos the Flatulent,
Something like that, yes.
as having been the second worst poet.
Right.
And then they mention number one worst poet in history was Paula Nancy Millstones Jennings.
Correct.
And as they are mentioning her, they actually put up one of her poems here.
Okay.
And I'll read it for you. It said, "The dead swans lay in the stagnant pool. They lay, they rolled. They turned around occasionally. Bits of flesh dropped off them from time to time and sank into the pool's mire. They also smelt a great deal."
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that's as bad as Vogon poetry, but you know, we'll figure it
there.
Out.
It's up there. We are introduced to Trillian, Zaphod, and Marvin. Trillian in no way matches the description in the book of dark hair and dark complexion.
Right. And in fact, this is what I was thinking about most when I started wondering when it was actually filmed, because her makeup is just over the top. I mean, the amount of blush and the blue eyeshadow and all of those kind of things just are so 70s, you know. Yes. I wondered whether they made it out of the 70s when they filmed this, you know.
Yeah, it always takes a year or two into the next decade to get their own look.
Right, exactly. And I was a little curious, too, because she's got kind of a interesting voice, kind of a squeaky sort of, you know, voice that...
Yes.
Is, and I was wondering about that, so I did a little bit of research. Come to find out that she's an American, unlike most of the other folks on right. the show. And when Douglas Adams interviewed her for the position, he said that he really loved her voice the way it was, because she said she could do a British or English accent. And he said, no, please don't. You know, I like it the way it is. So his influence is there with her choosing to use her own voice in that.
Oh, okay. So he liked it for this part.
Mm-hmm.
With the squeaky voice that he decided to keep, it really undercuts us believing that she has all these degrees in math and astrophysics. And it's not that she can't.
Right.
But this is a show where you're supposed to portray what the person is. So you would use stereotypes. And mm-hmm. they are certainly not using the math and astrophysics degree stereotype for her role.
Yes. 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 And the other thing I noticed that's a little odd for me anyway, they talk about Arthur having being actually 6 feet tall.
Yes.
And he does look it in the TV show here. But Zaphod is taller than he is.
Yes.
So, I mean, by a good 3-4 inches. It's so the man is, the Zaphod character, the actor who played the character, is taller. And then that makes Ford look like a little small guy,
right.
You know?
When they introduce Zaphod, they show him relaxing in a lounge beach chair. And mm-hmm. they have him positioned so he's turned to one side. And if you're not familiar with the character, it could appear that he only had one head. And
right.
then he eventually turns and gets up, which is, I think, supposed to be the reveal that mm-hmm. he has the second head. And the fake head is so obviously fake. And it's off to one side on his shoulder, not
right.
both heads centered.
Mm. Yeah, which would have been hard to imagine.
And it's wearing an eye patch for
yeah.
no apparent reason.
No, no. I'm not sure what the choice was there, but I know that they made a great effort at trying to make the faces of Zaphod be very similar.
They do.
In their makeup and color. But we talked about it before. It almost looks like a papier-mâché head.
Yeah.
And it does have some animatronics that are attached to it. And they attempted to use that for the mouth movement and the head turns. And it goes up and down and sideways occasionally. But in terms of effective makeup, I'm going to give that a D.
Yeah, I would agree.
It's barely there, right?
And then we finally get to meet Marvin.
Mm-hmm.
And he is asked to retrieve the aliens, and it mentions how the Encyclopedia Galactica defines a robot. And it is a mechanical apparatus designed to do the work of a man. And then they show drawings of many different robots. Did you mm-hmm. pay attention to them?
I guess I didn't. I must have missed
So
something.
There was just a drawing of all the robots and their names.
Oh, yeah.
So there was the Lumbermatic, and mm-hmm. it was cutting down a tree. And there was the Multitask Mobile. And mm-hmm. for some reason, it was carrying a cat by the tail. There was the Static, industrial version, which looked like it was holding a drill.
Mm-hmm.
The RB211, which is sweeping, not vacuuming. So they built a machine to sweep, not to vacuum.
Right.
The auto valet, which is carrying a tray with food and drinks.
Mm-hmm.
And then right in the middle of it all, doing nothing in particular, just a nice little throw-in for the fans, there's a Frog Star Scout.
Right.
Which doesn't come up till secondary phase and has nothing to do with any of this.
But right.
Frog Star Scout was right in there.
Right, of your plastic pals who's fun to be with.
Yes. When they were doing that part, they showed a version of Marvin that looked happy.
I know. He must have been one of the other people personalities they chose.
But they really didn't change anything about his appearance. It was just his demeanor and the way he kind of bounced around and all that, and probably having the bikini-clad girl
around that, and him. I think he had like light yellow eyes instead of the red ones.
Possibly.
And then this is where they're talking about, well, actually it's a little later on, I think. They're talking about the Sirius Cybernetics marketing department.
Oh yes, yes.
Did you catch that? There's actually when they talk about this, they were the guys that were the first up against the wall when the revolution came.
Correct, correct.
One of them is a picture of Adams.
Oh, all right. He was one of them. Another yes. one of his little cameos.
Yep, yep.
I like that they showed Eddie, and he's got all kinds of ticker tape falling to the floor around him, because I know I mentioned mm-hmm. before that I found it funny that he printed out ticker tape for no apparent reason in the radio right. series. We get to the part where Marvin has brought Arthur and Ford back from where they got beamed onto, or the ship, and they get to meet Zaphod. And there's something really weird happening with the stage direction here that confused me, and I'm trying to figure out exactly what they were trying to convey.
Okay.
So Ford introduced Arthur to Zaphod,
mm-hmm.
and Arthur says they've met. And Zaphod looks really confused and says, "Have we?" And it's a pretty generic line. You could say that if you had no idea what somebody was asking you. Mm-hmm. And Arthur starts talking about the party, and Zaphod looks even more confused and says, "I doubt that." And again, it's another generic line. Arthur is continuing on about the party, and Ford is arguing with him. And as all of that is happening, Zaphod gets up out of his chair, walks across the room over to a full tank of water, takes something from it, and puts it in his ear.
Right.
And
right.
from that point on, he totally knows what Arthur is talking about. Oh, that party. So to me, he had no idea what Arthur was saying until he put a babel fish in his ear, which leads me to believe that there's a expiration date, so to speak, of babel fish, and his battery died and he had to replace it. So did you catch that? What did you think of that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I did catch it. I thought it was a little strange because you do see that same configuration of the fish tank and dispenser when Ford gives Arthur his babel fish.
Yes.
So it was like you say, it was an obvious stage direction. When you saw the tank, you recognize it from the previous scene. He literally walks over there, picks something up, and puts it in his ear.
Yes.
So it definitely was doing that. The only thing I could think of, and it doesn't make any sense, is that he has one in his other ear. His other head. He needed another one for his other head because he was so confused.
Yeah. I don't know. But if the one he had died in his ear, he didn't take it out first.
Right.
Dead fish.
Yeah,
in his
there
ear?
You go. Okay.
Or maybe wriggled out.
We could write a whole book on the the life span and of the babel fish.
Right.
I think the last thing that, or one of the things that happens here, and I thought for sure that you would mention it, is as Trillian joins the boys on the bridge, you hear Eddie say, "Sum complete."
Yes, yes. That was the part that I liked that was on the LP that wasn't mm-hmm. in the radio show.
Mm-hmm. He actually says something like, "Added to -1, sum complete."
Yes. So then we get to chapter 3, and this chapter starts off with the passage that includes men were real men, and women were real women, and small furry creatures from Alpha Centauri were real small furry creatures from Alpha Centauri. Well, the actors just sat there. They were doing nothing. They were like flying a ship. So this guy is just sitting in the pilot chair, and this woman is just sitting in a co-pilot chair. And then there is a gigantic furry creature between them. And if that is a small one, I'd hate to see a large one.
I also wondered, and I thought you'd appreciate also the fact that the Heart of Gold does in fact look like a racing shoe.
It does. It does. So as we know, they're going to find the planet of Magrathea, and so the guide is doing the legend of Magrathea and explaining all of that. And there's graphics in the background, and the graphics are a little bit, I guess, school-like. Mm-hmm. It's very, very dry, very boring, very just, they were showing the layers of a planet and how it's constructed, and it's got the core and the man, you know, it's just going on, and it's nothing special. But at the very end, there's an optional outer layer called the meringue.
So I didn't see that. That's funny.
So you gotta, well, because you quit watching it because mm-hmm. it's just like going to school, and I don't want to know the layers of a planet. But mm-hmm. if you stick out through the whole thing, you'll see that there is an optional meringue layer. And of course, when they are orbiting Magrathea, they do the bit about nervous tension and stress. And while that whole passage is happening, on the screen they have what they call soothing pictures. So to keep everybody in the audience calm, they're showing soothing pictures so nobody gets upset.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you want to talk about and not using the medium to its potential, this is the part when they're listening to the recorded announcement from ancient Magrathea. They all just stand there staring at a hologram. So you've got this hologram, which is going to end up being Slarty Bart Fast.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got everybody in a circle around this hologram, motionless, watching a virtually motionless hologram give this message. It's like there's nothing happening on screen. There's mm-hmm, nothing mm-hmm. happening. So I don't know how they should have changed it, but they needed to do something to make that more interesting.
I agree. Yeah. Sorry.
No, that's fine.
Thinking about the meringue.
The meringue. And like in the radio series, they did a post-credit announcement that it was Arthur who bruised his upper arm.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're in episode 4. And this whole episode, in my opinion, did not benefit from TV. This episode was of their whole time on Magrathea. And most of that was the recounting of the story of the answer to the question as it was beamed into Arthur's head.
Right.
So most of the visuals were Arthur sitting on a chair or four men standing around a giant computer arguing, and Deep Thought doesn't move. He's a computer. So whenever right. he's talking, they're just showing this box with a couple of flashing lights that go in time to his speech. It was tedious.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's funny because when I first saw the two gentlemen that first approached Deep Thought to ask him the question, That really was a Monty Python-esque look to both of those gentlemen.
Oh, definitely.
I would have even sworn to you at a casual glance that it was one of the Python crew, but it in fact is not.
Oh.
The one thing I did think was kind of interesting, and it was a pretty good choice in my opinion, when Deep Thought is speaking and you're looking at Deep Thought's face, if you will, the front of him, they have it kind of coming down like a cloud of smoke sort of rolling down his face. And I thought that was kind of neat because it looked like a beard, you know, to make him more wizard-like. So
yes, yeah.
That part I did appreciate, but you're right. There's so much static in action in this episode. It's kind of different.
I did notice one little additional piece of dialogue. And I always like when they change just a little thing. They don't change much of the story, but they just add something. So when Deep Thought was explaining how long it would take him to come up with the answer, he says 7.5. And at this point, one of those asking for the answer is like, not until next week? Million years. So
yeah, I did like that. I thought that was pretty good.
So the guy was upset that he was going to have to wait until next week, and it's 7.5 million years. And then here's another little addition that I found interesting. Between the reels of the answer, Slarty Bartfast asked Arthur if he was anxious to know what the answer was.
Mm-hmm.
Even though he says, yes, quite, it was with a hint of sarcasm as he looks at his watch.
Right.
Where does he have to be? How could he possibly be bored with this technology that is beaming this right into his head? It just seems he doesn't seem to appreciate what he's going through.
Too much on his mind, I guess, huh?
That could be, yeah. He did just lose the Earth.
I do have a note here that I really appreciated the way that Magic Thighs and Broom Fondle, it's Broom Fondle who says, I think our minds are too highly trained, Magic Thighs.
Yeah. Yes. When they couldn't come up with the TV chat show circuit.
Right.
And then they made a small change for TV because I guess they thought that the visuals were going to be better. But the Vlaherg was wearing red bejeweled battle shorts instead of black.
Yes, yes. And the thing that I thought was the funniest, and only because I've spent hundreds of hours playing video games when I was young, was how they used the asteroids animation to depict the violent and despicable war that took place between the Gugungvunt and the Vlaherg folks.
Correct.
It just tickled me as those little triangular ships were shooting each other.
Yeah, so they do this whole battle thing, and I think my absolute favorite part of the whole TV show is that once they figured out what happened, one side had 10 ships and the other only had 8, and when the dialogue said, settled their few remaining differences, the side that had 8 shot 2 of them to even it out. And then they joined forces and went and were swallowed by the dog.
Right.
But the settled their few remaining differences, when they evened it out, that just cracked me up.
That's great.
The scene with the mice was odd. For some reason, they decided to film real mice.
Yes.
And the mice certainly aren't going to be in one place for very long. So the footage of the mice was always shown in like extreme slow motion.
Mm-hmm.
And they used the same couple of clips over and over and over. So they got very little useless footage of the mice.
Yes, they did. I mean, it is obvious. And when they say that working with animals in TV is very, very difficult.
Right.
It was an odd choice, but I kept thinking back to my irrational fear of anthropomorphized hamsters and was grateful that's all they did.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we didn't get to see them flying up in their wine glasses or whatever it is, like in the book.
Yeah, but I did think it was funny that Arthur jumped up on the table when he first saw him.
Right, right. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry, I forgot already. I just wasn't ready for it. There was one last added line that jumped out at me in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
When Shooty and Bang Bang were whining about not being easy to be a cop.
Right.
Ford says this line, "If we keep them talking, maybe their brains will seize up."
Right.
And it really reminded me of his theory on why humans always state the obvious.
Right.
It was just...
That's exactly what it was. Yep.
They do that earlier in the show. And then now they've got a very similar type of a line. I just thought that was kind of funny.
I also thought the two actors, you know, when they're playing Shooty and Bang Bang, there is a definite little nod that they do to each other at one moment. And it's like, it's a complete play off Laurel and Hardy.
Oh.
I mean, you'd have to look
yes.
at it.
Yes. Yes. Okay. I know what you mean now. Yes. I do remember that. I'm trying to think of what Laurel and Hardy always say at that. Point.
Yeah,
it's like a line.
Yeah, there is, but that, I mean, it was
even
like,
if it's like a So now we're in episode 5, and we have things to look at again in this episode. There is a lot that they did with Milliways. This seemed like a very big set with a lot of extras.
Right.
If you remember, there was the Pangalactic Gargo Blaster. And there was the girl that passed out after one sip.
Yes.
It looked like she was in the background.
She was. Or at least the exact same outfit was in the background.
Right.
You know?
Yes. In the audio dramas, unless there is narration where they're explaining the actions, there's no way to tell what the characters are doing.
Mm-hmm.
There's always just bumps and knocks and clinks and all of that. So here they've got an opportunity to do whatever they want in the restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
When the group first gets to Milliways, all the dialogue is pretty much the same.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the part where Zaphod has that epiphany,
right,
and realizes that they're at Milliways.
Right.
Well, we got to see that the drink menu, he saw the name and he sticks it in his coat and then pretends
yeah,
like
exactly.
He just figured it out.
Yep, yep.
So that's what I like when they can take something and not change anything, but add to the stories, things you couldn't see in the radio series.
Right. Yeah, that was a good little sequence. It fit his personality very well.
Yes.
And played well on the TV show.
Definitely. So instead of sticking with the primary phase script, they diverted to the LP and the book and used the Hot Black Desiato portion.
Right. Didn't you want to talk about Meat and the Meat?
That's after this, I think.
Oh, that's after this, right?
I'm not sure if I pointed this out before,
mm-hmm.
but when the group first got to Milliways thinking they were dead, the maitre d' said that they were not dead. Otherwise, he would not attempt to serve them.
Mm-hmm.
However, Hot Black is there. He's dead
yeah.
for tax purposes. And he's got a drink in front of him. So they serve dead people
there.
No,
they do. They do indeed. So I know we've spoken about this before. The Meet the Meat was always one of the most disturbing parts of this entire television show.
Yes, and this is something that could not be experienced in audio only.
No. Not at all. And the head of the bovine creature is disturbing, and the body is propped up on the table or whatever, you know, and I just love
platter.
And Zaphod goes up during the conversation and he's actually poking and prodding the animal.
Yeah, he's checking for tenderness. Yeah, oh man,
I know. And the animal is pointing with his hooves at different parts of his body, and then of course, you know, we know the result of it is that is it Ford or Zaphod that yells out, "Let's have four raw steaks or rare steaks"?
Zaphod says rare steaks.
And they go on, and that's when they then pan down to Quartoplene. But when they pan back to the group, after they've eaten or sat there at the table for a while, did you see the head of the bovine animal sitting on the table?
No, I didn't.
It's sitting on the table with an apple in its mouth.
All right. Now I'm going to have to watch that episode again just to see that.
Oh, it's quite disturbing.
Well, I also like that the meat also had a sense of humor. Mm-hmm. And you could poke fun and tease Arthur,
right,
knowing that Arthur was uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll just nip off and kill myself. Don't worry. I'll be very humane.
And I love the way he says, "A green salad." I know many vegetables who would be upset about that.
Yes. Then the last episode is episode 6.
It's interesting because we've talked about this again and again here, but during one of the discussions that they're having on the screen about the Cacrafoon people,
right,
they actually use the word Belgium.
Yep.
Which I thought was fun.
And like in the radio series, this is the episode where Marvin all of a sudden becomes a sarcastic smartass. Like the line about, "How can anyone live in something so small?" Mm-hmm. when talking about Arthur's brain. I like him when he is depressed.
Right.
And a Spock-like character using pure logic circuits.
Mm-hmm.
That said, I did like when after he told them that he knew and let them take Disaster Area's stunt ship, and Trillian said, "This is awful." In the radio series, we hear him say, "That's what I said."
Mm-hmm.
And he says it in this.
Right.
But when he says it, he leans forward and gets right in her face. Right. It was like perfect. So even though I like him as the serious, pure logic, showing that little bit of, you know, what I don't even know, moxie, mm-hmm. was great.
Right, right. And then I don't know if I can relate this little sequence that I thought was kind of funny. This is, someone says to him, "I'll be down in a minute." And then he says, "That'll be two of us."
Oh, yeah.
Mocking his own depression.
Right. So when Ford and Arthur finally get to the Golgafrinchian ship, this is where the visuals really add something.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things I thought was kind of fun, the kind of little thing that they put in here, is when Ford and Arthur end up on the B-Ark, for the first moments that they arrive, actually, as Arthur arrives, he realizes that he's wearing Ford's jacket and Ford's satchel.
Right.
And then, of course, yes, when Ford arrives, he's wearing Arthur's dressing gown. And right. It reminds me of the scene in the book that they do the little rhyme about the difficulties of transport and how, yes, they can switch things around. So I thought that was a cute little ad that they did here for the super fans like us.
Yeah, I can't remember the names, but somebody stole somebody else's heart away and somebody else got somebody's leg.
Right.
There was a whole thing about that.
Yep, yes. Yep.
I was trying to figure out what that meant when I was watching this, because they don't make any kind of reference to why things got switched.
No. Nope.
Yeah, call back to the book.
It is. It is. Mm-hmm.
The Golgafrinchians are an unusual bunch, and that can be accentuated by the wardrobe and their behavior. The joggers were ridiculous.
Yes.
I cannot believe anybody actually jogs in that manner.
Well, then you didn't watch them when you were back in the 70s, did you?
No.
Oh, it's very
common. The captain did not have much of a wardrobe.
Mm-hmm.
More or less, he just had props like a rubber duck and a bubble pipe.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there were gin and tonics. My favorite part of that scene was when Ford yelled out that they are a bunch of useless loonies.
Right.
The captain's slow revelation that that was the reason they were sent off first, and then the realization of what it meant, was perfect.
Mm-hmm.
His face just went through all the perfect emotions that conveyed what was going on.
Right, right. I did like that a lot.
On the planet, in this version, they were able to save the bath from his ship.
Yeah.
They didn't have to carve it out of a boulder. And I'm guessing that was budgetary reasons.
Yeah. That would make sense.
And I did like that they showed the Scrabble board and the Scrabble tiles. And like the discussion that we had before of how is tapping into your subconscious, grabbing tiles out of a Scrabble bag. All of the tiles were non-uniform and they were all hand-carved. So that could tap into Arthur's mind.
Yep. Yep.
Something that cracked me up that I found funny is when Ford and Arthur decided that they were fed up with the Golgafrinchians and they were going to look and see if this was actually Earth by mm-hmm. going to Norway.
Yes.
And looking for Slarty Bart Fast signature.
Right.
They build a raft and they push off.
Yeah.
And then it like cuts and then they have beards. Yep. And they come back to the exact same spot mm-hmm. that they left. So mm-hmm. that was some serious prehistoric Earth navigation to be able to do that this way.
Right, right. And I love the beards. I mean, the use of beards in the whole program were pretty good. And I was thinking about that because they do a little bit of fun. They poke a little bit of fun at that, too. Because, of course, when the first two guys that are talking to Deep Thought have these scraggly, unkempt beards, and then right. 7.5 million years later, when the people are arriving to hear the answer, they've got right. these fancy tied up, you know, updo beards, you know, so it's kind of a fun thing that they do with the facial hair.
Yes. And so Arthur finished his Scrabble game with the cavemen and they got the wrong question or what they think is the wrong question. And they decide that, well, that's it. We're just going to have to live out life. And like in the radio series, we've got Wonderful World that plays, mm-hmm. and it's just a peaceful, serene setting, and the show ends.
Right. And it makes you wonder, doesn't it? Because, of course, there's far more content that was available, and I didn't really look into it, but it must not have been too popular because it wasn't renewed, right?
No, they didn't make secondary phase, but what I'm wondering is, because secondary phase is so much different than restaurant,
mm-hmm.
if they didn't, because restaurant had to have been out by this time.
Right, right. It's very close.
So, right. So now they're stuck in this point of making a restaurant at the end of the universe type TV show
mm-hmm.
that doesn't match up with the book that they have just released.
Yep.
But all in all, I'm glad this exists, but I do not think it was the best use of the medium. But because it was based on the radio show, they didn't really have much option to do anything else because you have to keep the dialogue.
Right, right. And as you said from the beginning, it's been pretty clear that that's what they were seeking to do. And they stick pretty closely to that whole approach as in the radio show.
Right.
It does make you wonder. We're used to television here in the United States. And I think that the BBC and the way they approach TV has always been different.
Yeah.
The shows from back at that period of time were not heavily invested in scenery and that kind of thing. So where we might have a more sophisticated taste today, they definitely seem to be appropriate for the time, at least in the BBC's vision.
Correct. Yep, I agree. This brings us to the end of our episode about the BBC TV show. Next month, we're going to get back to the book series, and we are going to be doing So Long and Thanks for All the Fish.
Oh, I can't wait to see you do a double backflip into the sea.
Yeah, through a hoop while whistling the Star Spangled Banner.
And what better way to say goodnight, Jeff, than goodnight, Jeff.
All right. So then say goodnight, Jeff.
Okay. Goodnight, Jeff.
Thank you for listening to Digital Watches Are a Pretty Neat Idea. Look for us the first Thursday of every month for a full episode. We will also release a bonus episode later in the month. A very special thanks goes out to Luke, Max, Greg, and Tim Lesnick for arranging and performing our opening theme. We would also like to thank our talented friends and family for their voice work on our introductions and commercials. Visit our website at digitalwatchesareaprettyneatidea.buzzsprout.com, where you can find links to all my Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy-inspired t-shirt designs. You can find us on Facebook and YouTube as Digital Watches Are a Pretty Neat Idea, on Instagram as Watches Idea Podcast, and on Twitter at Watches Idea. If you'd like to contact us, our email is digitalwatchespodcast@gmail.com.
This has been a Fruits for Thought production.